Good evening. I told everybody this morning, and there's a lot of visitors tonight, but to paraphrase Amos, I'm not a preacher nor the son of a preacher, so bear with me. My lesson this evening and one of them from this morning, I do have to publicly thank Ken Ledbetter. He had helped a lot with the slides that I had used. And during this talk, we are going to look at the world around us, the natural revelation. And one of the things that we will be doing is looking at clips from the planetarium show from the Creation Museum. And so with that, intermittently, we'll be watching short little videos, which is a bit unusual, but I'm not normal. So. And looking at the topics that we're going through, just a reminder, these are not exclusive. These are just to pique your interest. Each of these could be a whole semester college course studying and probably still wouldn't make a dent. But tonight we're dealing with natural revelation and how God shows us who He is. And we looked through these verses this morning, but just a reminder that God says you can look around the world. You can see me by looking around. And what I call the theme text in Romans, it's obvious. God says you're without recourse because you can look around and see my divine nature. You can look around and see my eternal power. They are clearly understood. So when we look at science, if we look at creation, what is that? Science is our attempt to understand the world through nature and through looking at natural law. Natural law is explaining how and why things work, how they happen. There's a set of natural laws for everything that exists. I'll just put a few of them here. But pretty much everything in nature, some mathematician or some biologist, has tried to explain in a formula about it. And most of the time they do a very good job. What always amazes me is looking at how they figured that out. How do they figure out gravity, the laws of gravity, using the instruments of the day? It just boggles my mind, the speed of light. They did all these calculations that today, we can say, well, we got the instruments for that. Back then, they didn't, and they still figured it out. So there are some very smart men. But if you look at creation, only God knows the set of laws perfectly because He created them. They are orderly. They are logical because God says He is not an author of confusion. He is an orderly God. They function perfectly because He is perfect. He set the laws in motion. And they might seem complicated to us because we are not God. God says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, my ways are not your ways. Speaking of other things, but to extrapolate that in science, that goes for the same thing. We do not understand everything because God does, and He hasn't revealed that to us. And so the scientific method is how we try to explain things. You have a theory. I think this is how I'm going to explain things. Well, let's test it and test it and test it. If it doesn't fail, it becomes a law. If it does fail, well, your theory wasn't good. Let's go back and revise it and keep going. Eventually, you might get to something that's a law, but later you figure out, well, it needs some tweaking. Evolution and creation are both theories. We can't prove them. We can't get a test tube and do either one. We haven't been able to. And so your job as the listener, your job as the student, is to test both of those, to see the data, to see the evidence, and to say which one best explains what we're looking at. I have done that numerous times, and I will tell you, I think creation explains everything. I think a worldwide flood. When you start looking at the world around you, those type of things we read about in the scriptures explain what we see best. But that's your job to figure that out for yourself. And neither can be proven until the day of judgment. God can tell us, oh, this is exactly what I did and how I did it. But until then, it's just a theory. Think about some examples. Newton's law of gravity. It was a law up until Einstein. And then we had to tweak it a little bit because of Einstein's theories. There was a law in the 1930s that you could not fly faster than the speed of sound because planes would fall apart. Well, that was a theory that is no longer a law. even thinking about things that we might read about in the text of our Bibles. I remember growing up, King James Bible had the dates in there all the way back to October of 4004 when creation started. Well, that's because of Usher had calculated it out. I think he was wrong. He missed a few years there, here and there, but that was the best thing at the time. So if we look at the world around us, though, at creation, it is boggling just how astounding the beauty and the design. When I was in medical school, I had a lot of professors who would say, it is amazing how Mother Nature designed us. They could freely admit we were designed, but they couldn't attribute it to the right source. The thought of irreducible complexity comes into place, where, if you know that theory, it's some things, when you get it down to the barest minimum, some things cannot work unless they're all there at the same time. So a mousetrap is the best example. If you had a board, well, why would you evolve a spring on the board until you get all of those parts? So it had to be designed. It couldn't just come about by chance. And maybe there were other functions that those housed, but together you have to have all of those for it to work. And when I look at creation, when I look at the body, when I look at the world around us, that's exactly what I see. I postulate God designed it. We are told in Psalm 19 that the heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament shows his handiwork. In this first video, I just want you to look at our solar system and a little bit beyond, and just to gain an insight into what we're talking about and what we're looking at.
One extraordinary aspect of creation is the incredible range of sizes and distances we observe. The International Space Station orbits approximately 200 miles above the surface of the Earth. This is far higher than any aircraft, and yet it really isn't very far into space. The Earth itself is nearly 8,000 miles in diameter, and yet the expanse beyond extends to distances that we cannot truly comprehend. The space station and other man-made satellites represent only the surface of a celestial ocean. The Apollo astronauts traversed a much greater distance. Traveling at the speed of a bullet, they took 3 days to reach the moon. The moon lies at an average distance of 240,000 miles from Earth. This is the farthest that human beings have traveled into space. Yet, the Earth's distance from the sun is 400 times greater. The Earth orbits at an average distance of 93 million miles from the sun. But the outer planets orbit at much greater distances. Neptune orbits 30 times farther from the sun than Earth does. The dwarf worlds Pluto and Eris are even farther out. Their orbits do not lie in the same plane as the planets. The orbits of all the planets could be contained in a cube that is 6 billion miles on a side. Yet, the distance to the stars is far greater. The next nearest star system is Alpha Centauri. How many solar systems would fit between the Sun and Alpha Centauri? The answer is an astonishing 4,278. It is a distance that is almost impossible to imagine.
So to get to our closest neighbor, you have to travel over 4,000 times the distance, the diameter of just our local solar system. How about going further?
Now we will travel much deeper into space, several hundred light years toward Orion's belt. On our journey, we get a sense of the astonishing distance to these stars. The Hyades star cluster is visible on our right. we pass Bellatrix, the nearest of Orion's bright stars. Next out, Betelgeuse slowly drifts across the scene. A myriad of faint stars continually glides past our field of view. We are now roughly 400 light years away from home. As we pick up speed, we pass by Rigel and Safe. Finally, we reach the nearest stars of Orion's belt. We have traveled a distance of 5 million billion miles into space. We glance back in the direction of the solar system. It is located here. However, the sun could not be seen from this distance without a telescope. It is a humbling experience to think of our entire solar system reduced to an invisible point.
So we've gone to Orion's belt, and we're still in the Milky Way. These are vast distances, and you know, thankfully we marked you are here, and just in case you wondered where you were. But we're in this spiral arm, and when we talk about the distances, this 100,000 light years that is across, remember, this is not a period, a measurement of time. It's a measurement of distance. When we talk about light years, that's a measurement of distance. It's the amount of that light would travel in 1 year, and you can measure that out. That's because these are big dimensions. But that is a big distinction that we'll talk about in a little bit. But if we're in our Milky Way and we look out, depending on how we look, we might not see much. If you looked directly into our own solar system, into our own galaxy, it would be hard to see because of all the stars. But if you look outside the spiral arm, if you look either way out of that plane, you'll see what look like a lot of stars all over. And it looks like there's not much there. This is actually a spot that we pointed Hubble at. And then since then, we've done the James Webb Telescope and gotten even better pictures. But if you take a dime and you hold it at arm's length, there's nothing there until you look and you realize that dark spot is filled with not just stars, but galaxies. And it seems everywhere we look, there are galaxies, mature galaxies all over. And it brings to mind the passage, "What is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you care?" Because here we are nothing. We're just dust on an insignificant planet in the middle of nowhere. But God looked down and he loved us. In Psalms we're told, "O Lord, how many are your works? In wisdom you have made them all. The earth is full of your possessions." But let's look a little bit further into space.
This is our galaxy, the Milky Way. It spans 80,000 light years across and contains more than 100 billion stars. The Milky Way is a spiral galaxy. The brighter stars are concentrated into arms that wrap around the disk. Since our solar system is within this disk, we see the Milky Way as a cloudy band in our night sky. No human being or spacecraft has seen our galaxy from the outside, as shown here. It is difficult to grasp just how large our galaxy is. Our solar system is located here. In fact, with the exception of M4, all the stars and planets we've visited are within this little ring. The Milky Way is a remarkable demonstration of God's power. But what's even more amazing is that our galaxy is merely one of billions. Every one of these faint clouds is an entire galaxy. As we pan upward, we see a strange band where galaxies seem to be missing. This is called the zone of avoidance and is aligned with the disk of our galaxy. Although many galaxies are undoubtedly in this region, gas and dust in our own galaxy prevent us from seeing them.
But it is amazing the way our Milky Way is, that we can look up and down, we just can't look out, and so we can see a lot more of space. Complex life, which is us, is allowed on this planet. And there are a number of factors that people will quote if you start reading. So when you read about evolution, they will say these factors allowed us to evolve for life to become. I will tell you, from my perspective, these factors allow the creation to exist here. But we are in an amazing position both in our solar system as well as in our galaxy. We're just the right distance from the sun, that it's not too hot, it's not too cold. We have the most perfect position for liquid water, which is necessary for life. And we talk about going to other planets. We're looking for planets that have water, or we have to bring liquid water with us. If we were at the center of the galaxy, there'd be way too much radiation. We wouldn't be able to survive, but we're out on a spiral arm. If we were in a globular cluster, we wouldn't be able to see anything in space because there'd be too many stars all around us. It'd be too bright. The size of our sun gives just the right amount of electromagnetic radiation. It's a uniform spectrum, so we get heat, we get light. We have a liquid core of iron that gives us a magnetic field to protect us from that solar radiation. What about our tectonics, the earthquakes? Well, earthquakes and volcanoes, they allow us to recirculate elements. We have a moon to stabilize our tilt, allowing seasons and less wobble to our planet. We have a nearly circular orbit, but if it was too much elliptical, it would get too hot and too cold. And so we're kept within a certain parameter that allows life to exist. We have outer gas planets. You remember a while back, well, it's probably a decade or two now, the comet that crashed into Jupiter. Why do we have those outer gassy planets? Well, they protect us. They're a shield. Most solar systems, when they start looking, they have what they call a hot Jupiter, where they have something like Jupiter, but it's in where Mercury or Earth is. And so if you have that, life can't exist on a planet like Earth. But we have the outer planets or the gassy planets, not the inner ones. The odds of this coming about, we won the celestial lottery multiple times over for life to be here. But one of the biggest wins is water. So what's so special about water? It's got lots of properties. Our planet is 70% water. Our body is mostly water. Why is it so important? Well, the equation of life. You have water, you have carbon dioxide, you can get sugar and oxygen. And you're constantly recirculating these, both you and the world around us. What about water? Well, it has a very high specific heat. And so when we look at specific heat, water slowly gains or loses heat, which is very good because if we're in different extremes in temperature, if it's 90 degrees outside, you don't want to sweat and perspire too much too quickly. If it's cold, you don't want it freezing too quickly. Water has an amazing ability to generate a very uniform heat for us in our body. Otherwise, as much as I get cold now and people have hot flashes, it would be a lot worse. What about water? Well, the heat required to evaporate water is extremely high. Y'all know this from perspiration. But it takes a large amount of heat to cause evaporation or to cause perspiration. In the atmosphere, we think about the water vapor cycle. That is very crucial to a lot of things. But the heat of vaporization saves us. How about the density of water? It's the greatest at 39 degrees. So as it gets cold outside and the surface temperature of the water cools, as it gets to 39 degrees, it gets denser and it drops. It brings oxygen down to the fish. It brings warmer water up to the top. You get the circulation as water gets colder. Just like you stirring a bathtub if you put too much hot water in and you're now trying to cool it off or vice versa. But this stops as it gets closer to freezing. At 39 degrees and below, that circulation stops. Why is that important? Well, if you get everything down to 32 degrees, all the fish are going to freeze to death, and you don't want that. You want the warmer water down, and so you circulate, you get the oxygen down to the fish, and then it stops. What else is important? Well, now you got colder water on top, slightly warmer water down below. What happens when water freezes? This is a very unique property. One of the few things that does it is when water freezes, its density gets less. Ice floats. Most liquids, almost all liquids, freeze from the inside out. Gets coldest, and then as it gets colder, the rest of it freezes as well. If that were true with water, everything in the lake would die when it froze. But it doesn't, because ice floats. The chemical structure of water is so rare, we don't see that in anything else. The angles at which it comes together cause it to be lighter and denser. Now, already, this is a lot of properties for one particular molecule. Is that a coincidence? Is that just random chance? Is that design? What else about water? It's an excellent solvent. Those of you who've been in the chemical lab, you know that most chemical reactions, a lot of them will not occur unless water is present. It's a great catalyst. Sometimes a very explosive catalyst. You ever go with your science crew and you drop sodium off a bridge? It's a pretty explosive catalyst sometimes. But animal blood, tree sap, most things that we need in life that are liquid, somehow water is involved with them. Water is a stable compound. You have to heat water up to 3,140 degrees Fahrenheit to break water apart. And even when you do it, you're only breaking 0.5% of water into hydrogen and oxygen. The nice thing about it is water pretty much no matter what the temperature, no matter what you need, you know it's going to be water. Water also, if you add the right oxide to it, you're going to get a base, or you're going to get an acid. Bases and acids, when they come together, you know water is one of the byproducts of that. But most of our biochemical reactions of life need acids and bases. So for us to survive, for animals to survive, we need water. This is the really cool one. You go out today, well, today's probably a little bit too warm, but you go out when it's cold, especially down to a river, you're going to see all three forms all at once. Sometimes at the same temperature, water will be in liquid, solid, and gaseous form. And so liquid water, solid water, and vaporized water can all coexist on this planet. And they all have properties that we can use. Is that design? Is that coincidence? We are looking for water all over the universe because we want to go explore. We want to go find places. And where does it seem a bulk of the water in the world, in the universe is? It's right here on our planet. How did that happen? Looking back at the universe, in Psalm 147, we are told, He counts the number of the stars. He gives name to all of them. Great is our Lord and abundant in strength. His understanding is infinite. We had enough problem naming six kids, trying to find names for them. 100 billion galaxies with 100 billion stars each. We number them, M34, M39, you know, we have numbers. God has named every single one of those, He tells us. Like we mentioned this morning with Ecclesiastes 3:11, God has put eternity in our hearts so that we will look for Him. I think He's also given us an ability to look at space, so we will look for Him. He has given us the ability to look inside of cells, so we will look for Him.
From the Virgo cluster, our entire galaxy appears as a grain of sand, lost in a vast ocean of galaxies. Yet the galaxies shown here are only a small portion of the cosmos. Beyond this distance, astronomers have cataloged only certain regions of the visible universe. At last, we begin to see the large-scale structure of the universe. The galaxies are organized into a complete tapestry of strings and voids. For clarity, only a few selected regions are shown here. This is the universe, or at least as much of it as our present understanding makes possible. Just imagine the power involved as all these galaxies leapt into existence at God's command. And yet the Bible describes the creation of all this with the single phrase, He made the stars also. The psalmist writes, When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the Son of Man that you visit him.
So as we look at this vast universe, there are two views that you have to take. Either it has always existed, or it had a beginning. And then if you say it had a beginning, where did it come from? That's the next logical question. And if you don't want to answer where it came from, you have to say it always existed. Science can't answer questions going beyond the beginning or at the end of the universe. But it firmly points that there was a beginning and there will be an end. If you look at the Earth, whether it's radioactivity decaying, the contents of the universe continuing to expand and go out, we're going towards entropy. The total energy of the universe is decreasing. Stars are wearing out. And that agrees with the Bible. The Bible says there was a beginning. The Bible says there'll be a definite end. The Bible also says that things are wearing out. Just read the end of Ecclesiastes and you can find out what happens when we wear out. But 90% of the evidence, in my view, points to a young Earth. When you look at the fact that the moon is slowly pulling away from the Earth, the magnetic field is slowly slowing, or Earth's rotation is slowing, size of our sun going away, it can't be billions of years old and us to have been here. I think it points to a young Earth. If you think about our star that we constantly go around every year, our sun is being consumed. Every second of every day, 564 million tons of hydrogen are being transmutated into 559 tons of helium. 5 million tons are converted into energy. That's every second. The sun is losing 5 million tons of fuel. It's being converted into energy. Second law of thermodynamics says that stuff runs down. There's no perpetual motion machines. Everything will wear out. But in the midst of this, we have had people looking at red shifts and blue shifts and trying to work to say, how old is the universe? And Alan Guth is one who coined the term the Big Bang in the 50s. And this actually, on the cover, is a picture of how big the universe was supposed to be at 10 to the minus 34th seconds after things existed. And so they've extrapolated out and said, based on what we see, we think this started 13 billion years ago. But what about the physics of this? What would have happened? So at the very beginning, there's no time, no space. At 10 to the minus 43, the entire universe is smaller than an atom. The temperature is 10 to the 33rd degrees Fahrenheit. And because there's so much there, only energy and the force of gravity exist. It's very hot, it's expanding rapidly, but there's too much mass and temperature for any other physical properties to exist. We're not even a second, we're now at 10 to the minus 10 seconds. The temperature has cooled off enough that electromagnetism and weak nuclear forces are in place. All the laws of physics are now in place. But what people will tell you is the universe had to know the constants before it started, because otherwise this wouldn't have worked. Well, how does the universe know the constants if something wasn't put there by somebody else? But at 10 to the minus 4, energy begins to convert into matter, so E equals mc squared. You have subatomic particles forming. 3 minutes after time began, you're now at a balmy 2 billion degrees. It's gotten a lot cooler. The laws of physics, once again, had to be in place. You're getting protons and neutrons forming, and you have a small number of lithium nuclei. And then 300,000 years afterwards, the temperature of the universe is now down to 4,000 degrees. Atoms and elements can now form. And so that is what we're told if we work physics back and say this happened 13 billion years ago according to physics. Well, what kind of physics laws are finely tuned? All these constants, the speed of light, the weak and the strong nuclear forces, the electron mass, the proton mass, atomic mass, the mass of the universe, Planck's constant, gravity, Boltzmann's constant. You have all these constants that the universe had to know for science to say things would have worked. So if the universe and the matter are not eternal, but there was a beginning, where did all of this come from? And we are told that it had to be 13 billion years ago, because the size of the universe, when we look out and we can see, the diameter is 93 billion light years, and the edge of the observable universe is 46.5 billion light years. Now don't forget, light years isn't time, it's a measure of distance. So I am asked, if the 6 days of creation is correct, and this happened about 6 to 10,000 years ago, how can we see that far into the universe? I turn around and ask them the same question, because they have the exact same problem as me. If the universe is 13 billion years, how come I can see 46.5 billion light years in the distance? It's the same problem. We both have the same problem. Whether you go with a big bang or whether you say God made everything, the universe appears older than we actually say it is, no matter if you are a creationist or you're an evolutionist. So the fun thing is, you can explain it with multiple thoughts. One, you could say, well, God made Adam and Eve adults. He didn't make them babies. He made a mature universe. He could have made it so at just the right time, if this took 13 billion years to happen, he made it and said, okay, here it is. It's just going to look old. He could have made it 13 billion years ago, just let there be light. And then later, when the time was right, he said, okay, I'm going to make the stars and the moon, I'm going to make man. Another thing is, he could have done it 6,000 years ago. And we know the speed of light is a constant, but time is not. And this is what really messes with your mind. We have GPS satellites all around us, but they have to time them at different rates, because the distance from the Earth, gravity is less, and their clocks run differently. There's theories that the speed of light has changed over time, but more likely is gravity can affect time. We have actually seen that, where gravity affects time. And so if you have everything close together, it is going to affect time and how light works. So there's a lot that we have to think about that we don't have the answers for. Now, I know there are some people in the audience who love astronomy and could probably do a much better talk on what I'm doing today. But I want you to all think about, when you go outside and look up and see the stars, really, how insignificant are we in the scheme of things? When we look at the universe around us, we're really not anything. But the Creator came, and almost like getting down on your hands and knees and making little mud pies, He made us with His hands, it says. He spoke everything into existence. Like it mentioned, He made the stars also. Just five little words. It's kind of like an afterthought. Oh yeah, I'll make some stars too. But with man, He got down and He breathed life into us. He told us we're special. And when we look around at the universe around us, we have to say either this is all eternal, because nothing made it, or we have to say it was created. And a lot of interesting, prominent scientists have said we were made. Francis Crick, think about the double helix of DNA, he's one who helped discover that. He says actually aliens put us on this planet. I tell him, I agree with you. An alien put us on this planet. An alien created us and put us on this planet. I just happen to have his diary here. Stephen Hawking. There is no God. He was very much an atheist. But he said we were basically put on this planet as an experiment. It's called panspermia, where we came from somewhere else and were placed here. I have to agree with him as well. Something put us here. I just happen to have his book. But I think when you look at prominent scientists, they're realizing that this couldn't have happened by chance. Something had to have designed us. Something had to have put us here. But they're failing to attribute it to the right sources. Let me give you one more video. And with this, we're at the edge of the universe. And every time we go 4 seconds, we're going 90% of the way home. So every 4 seconds, you go 90% home. How long does it take us to get home?
We will now travel back home by zooming in by a factor of 10 every 4 seconds. The little circle is 10 times smaller than the large one. Every time we see a new circle, we've traveled 90% of the remaining distance home. The strings and voids of galaxies seem to disappear as we approach home. We plunge into the nearest several dozen galaxies called the Local Group. The Milky Way becomes visible at last. We're approaching our galaxy from almost directly above. We enter the Milky Way between two of the spiral arms. We can now see that these arms are comprised of billions of stars. As we approach our solar system, the stars slow down and converge to their familiar positions. We pause briefly to note that we are now able to recognize the constellations. The sun is dead ahead, but from this distance it appears as a faint star. At last, we reach the solar system. The orbits of the outer planets are highlighted. We can now see the orbits of the inner planets, but the Earth itself is still invisible from this distance. The Earth may seem an insignificant speck compared to all that God created. Yet, this tiny world is where God placed the crowning jewels of His creation. Of all that the Lord created, human beings alone have the privilege of being made in God's own image. And though we have rebelled against our Creator, He's paid the penalty for our treason. It was on this small planet where the Creator of the universe became a man and died our death. He then rose again and has offered forgiveness for all who call upon His name. It is fitting that we should honor God for who He is and for what He has done.
So talking about where we live and winning the celestial lottery, that pales in comparison to what we have also won by the Creator forgiving us, sending His Son so that we could live with Him for all eternity. If you're not a Christian, you need to be one. Because in this life, you can get it whatever you want, but if you've gained it all and you don't make it to heaven, it's not going to be worth it. If you have a need to respond to God's call to be His child, if you have any needs that you need to bring before the congregation here, please come forward as we stand and sing.